The Enigma of Capital by Professor David Harvey, City University of New York, November 14th, 2008. For more, see www.davidharvey.org.
Okay, before I get into what I really want to talk about, I thought I'd better say just a few comments on the current situation. And it goes something like this. I'm frequently asked, is what's going on right now the end of neoliberalism? And my answer to that is, well, it depends what you mean by neoliberalism. My view of neoliberalism is that all along it's been about the attempt to restore and consolidate class power. And from that perspective, I don't think what we're seeing happening right now is the end of that at all. I think it's the culmination rather than the end of it. And I say that for a couple of reasons, because that tactic, that objective, if you like, of consolidating and restoring class power was worked out through, with the help of an ideology about individual liberty and freedom and all of that. It was worked out also through a bunch of practices around using the market to do that tactically. And you use the market whenever it was convenient. When it wasn't convenient, you dropped it. Along with it went, of course, this whole kind of notion of privatization of the surplus, privatization of as everything that could be privatized, the commodification of everything, the issue of personal responsibility and the withdrawal of the state from actual a lot of social provision. But these were, I think, tactics to an end. And actually, if you look at the practices of neoliberalism, they didn't conform to the ideology, and in fact, they gave away pretty fast. And what I saw coming out of the fiscal crisis of New York City in the 1970s were two major principles, and then a third sort of tagged onto it. And the two major principles were that in the event of a conflict between the well-being of financial institutions and the well-being of a people, you chose the well-being of the financial institutions and screwed the people. And if you look at the tactics of the bailout right now, I defy you to see that it's anything other than a continuation of that. That's exactly what is happening. The second principle, which I think was terribly important in the New York case, was that government didn't withdraw at all from the economic realm. Government changed its vision and changed its role, and it occurred in bits and pieces, but effectively what it meant was if there was that the government was supposed to be very active in providing a good business climate. In particular, to sort of encourage investment and all the rest of it, and the encouragement of the creation of a good business climate was therefore fundamental to what state policy was about. And again, as in the first condition, this condition also was that if there's a conflict between providing a good business climate and the well-being of the people, you provide the good business climate, and then you usually legitimated that with kind of commentaries about trickle-down or everything, you know, tides lift all boats and all that kind of rhetoric, which of course never ever really happened. But part of that business climate also meant something else, which is a change in the way in which state power was organized and operated. And it's very interesting, the words I think betray some of this, that one of the words which came in was the idea of governance rather than government. And governance meant the sort of integration of state and private stakeholder interests, which I wrote about back in 1980s, kind of said, well, what this really means is that you get into a lot of public-private partnerships in which the public bears all of the risk and the private takes all of the profits. And again, I defy you to look at what's been happening recently and say that is not exactly what is going on. So that, by my view, what is going on right now is a culmination. The only interesting question for me is how is this thing going to exit? And I think that's already been pretty much predetermined. It's a It's a chronicle of a policy foretold, if you want to call it that. And the policy is going to simply be about further consolidation, further monopolization, particularly in the financial sector, with a great deal of assistance from state power, particularly from, of course, the central banks. And we may be moving into a world in which the dictatorship of treasury departments and central banks is going to dominate pretty much everything that is going to be done. So that, if you like, is the exit, a kind of a financial form of what we used to call state monopoly capitalism, where there's going to be very tight controls pretty much exercised through consolidated power. Now, to be sure, there's been a lot of bloodletting on Wall Street, but those that are left standing are very much more powerful than they were before. And I think that what we're going to see, therefore, is that even further consolidation of class power. Is there anything that's going to resist that? The answer is I don't see the configuration of class forces right now is of the sort that is going to be able to really challenge that. So I think it's pretty much a done deal as to how we're going to come out of it. But what I think we do have is a legitimation crisis, because actually the way in which everything's been legitimated over the last 30 years has been about private interests and liberty and freedom and all those kinds of things and the free market and all this kind of stuff. That's taken a pretty hard knock, and it's going to be pretty hard to make that argument stick. So I think we're going to be in a very serious legitimation crisis over the next few years, because that particular kind of form of argument will not, I think, work. So that is, if you like, how I see the current situation, and we can come back to that in the discussion as much as you like. But what I really wanted to do today was to pose the following question, which has been sort of been fussing with for some considerable time, which is, How does capitalism actually get reproduced? How does it get sustained? How does capitalism as a social system stay alive? And this, to me, seems to me to be the enigma that I want to address. And I think it's something that is, of course, thrown up by the present circumstance, but I have to find some way to attack it and ask questions about what it takes to reproduce capitalism, what has to be done, and why it is that it happens. Now, at this point, I'm kind of thought, well, maybe what I should do is come up with a particular kind of methodological thing and ask the first question, which would be, what are the conditionalities that allow capitalism to continue as a socioeconomic and political system? And by doing a pretty reductionist thing, I think you can start to identify what some of these conditionalities are. And then you ask the question, well, how is it that those conditionalities get perpetuated and get realized? How is it those conditions, you know, by what means are they realized? By whom are they realized? And you get round to sort of political subjectivities and agencies and all the rest of it. But I want to spend most of the time today really talking simply about conditionalities, to get some sort of picture of what it is that capitalism is about as a system and how it works. And on this, of course, I go back to sort of very basic sort of fundamental views of how a capitalist system is set up and what a capitalist system has to do, and then sort of look at it and think about the various conditionalities that are implied in this process. Now, Marx held that capitalism was a process, not a thing. And the simplest way to look at this process is to take what Marx does in Capital and say, look, okay, here's the process, and we have to look at the continuity of this process. Basically, it works like this. A capitalist starts with a certain amount of money, goes into the market, buys labor power, buys means of production, combines those with a given technology in a production process. Out of that production process, there comes a commodity, which is then sold for the original money plus the surplus value or the profit. Then there's a continuity condition, that part of this surplus value gets reinvested. So the next time around, you need, when you combine this together, you go back in and you go back and you buy labor power plus an increment of labor power. You go back in and you buy means of production plus an increment of means of production. And so it goes on and on and on and on indefinitely. Now, there are a number of things that can be said about this system that And one of the big question marks immediately is that what is it that causes the reinvestment function? Why is it that a part of the surplus value gets reincorporated as fresh capital to start actually going on? Why does that happen? We'll get to that a little bit in a minute. But this process has a number of characteristics. The first thing is that you can see straight away that if it works on a trouble-free way, then actually this is going to be a system that is going to grow at a compound rate. So you're going to get a compound rate of growth. And actually, historically, since it's the origins of industrial capitalism around 1750 or 1780 or whenever, the rate of growth has been around 3%. Sometimes it's been less, sometimes it's been more, but it's just kept on going. In other words, 3% of the capital that came in yesterday gets reinvested in further expansion, and so it goes on and on and on. Now, the result of this is that a capitalist system is perpetually growing in size. And I was interested the other day when I was in the Natural Science Museum, there's a thing there, and the following data. It said, in 1750, the total output of goods and services working through the market at that time was something the order of 135 billion. By the time you get to 1950, it's 4 trillion. By the time you get to 2000, it's 40 trillion. Now, one of the first things this tells you is that a 3% reinvestment function on the basis of 4 trillion is a different kind of story from a reinvestment function on 40 trillion. And it's not hard to see that in the next 20 years, if Gordon Brown's speech today was correct, this is going to double, so we're going to have an $80 trillion economy in 20 years' time. And then 20 years after that, you'll have $160 trillion economy. In other words, this system is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore there are the problem of reinvestment, where is the reinvestment going to go, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Put very simply, if you imagine what it was like to try to sort of expand at a compound rate of 3% when all capitalist activity was confined within a 50-mile radius of Manchester and a few other places, that's one story. Another story is when you're thinking about actually a 3% rate of growth on everything that's going on in China, a lot of what's going on in South Asia, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in Latin America, what's going on in Europe, what's going on in North America and the like. I mean, these are two different stories, as it were. And at some point or other, you can see that this is going to be of a very significant kind of issue. And the reason this also comes about is the following, and this is one of the key observations that Marx made about this system. The end of this system is money. And from the standpoint of accumulation, there is absolutely no limit to how much money there can be. I mean, where is it? And that is even true in terms of private appropriation. So part of what you're finding at the end of this sequence is a concern to gain more and more money, because money is a form of social power. And so part of the reinvestment is a quest for social power and an increase in social power, because those who have it want to keep it, and those who don't have it try to get it. So you keep on going on this kind of... So there's a tremendous kind of drive, a psychological drive to acquire this power, and there is no limit to that. I mean, I thought it was outrageous when in 2005 the leading hedge fund owners took home $250 million personal remuneration in 1 year. In 2006, somebody brought in $1.7 billion personal remuneration. Last year, it was four, I don't know, you saw yesterday in those five guys lined up before the Senate, for the House committee or whatever it was. Each one of them got more than $3 billion in 1 year. I mean, this is what I mean by the limitlessness of money and the limitlessness of acquisition of money. I mean, Imelda Marcos had, 6,000 pairs of shoes? And there's a limit to how many McMansions you can have and how many yachts you can have. So when you're talking about use values, you're talking about limits. But when you're talking about money, you're talking about something that's, in principle, limitless. And this is one of the characteristics of the capitalist kind of system. So you're dealing with this, and that's where that 3% kind of growth rate starts to become become critical. And where are you going to put all that money? Once you've got it, you've got it as a form of social power, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to use it? Those are the kinds of issues which we get back to. Now, when you inspect this system, however, and I think this is where I want to come down to sort of a very simple reflections on this system, when you inspect this system, what you see are a number of potential barriers to the flow. And Marx argues that the continuity of the flow is absolutely fundamental for capital. That when the flow stops for any reason, when things jam up, then everything starts to collapse. And we're seeing that with the freezing of the credit markets. We saw it most dramatically after 9/11, for about 2 days, all the flow stopped. And then all of a sudden, Giuliani and everybody came out and said, for God's sake, get your credit cards out and start shopping again, because otherwise this system is going to collapse. And that is the case, that the flow has to continue. And that means that this process, this flow, is something that has to be looked at and dissected in terms of, are there potential barrier points in this process? And I was very impressed last year when I went back and taught the Grundrisse, that the central part of the Grundrisse is very much about the notion of limits, potential limits, and then talks about the relationship between limits and barriers, and the barriers which can be transcended and circumvented. And this language of limits becoming barriers, which then get transcended and circumvented, seems to me something that's terribly important, because there are a lot of potential limits in this process. And having written one of the books called The Limits to Capital, I thought I'd better go back and think about this whole kind of process of limits once again, in bit by bit. And you look, therefore, at this continuous process, and you look at the various moments in this process and ask, what's going on at that moment where there's a potential limit, potential barrier, and how does that barrier get circumvented and the like? The first point you would look at is this. You look at the money. And you ask the question, where does the original money come from? Where does the capitalist get the money in the first instance? Now, of course, Marx had a theory of primitive accumulation, which basically said, well, you go off and you rob the rest of the world. That's what merchant capital did. That's what, so it's piracy, banditry, usury, and all the rest of it. So there's a whole kind of theory of primitive accumulation that talks about the ways in which this monetary power was originally assembled. And so people got the gold, and so they had that. Now, the tendency is to say, well, once that happened, but I think this is a continuing kind of process, and the continuing process is to find the money, to pull the money together in such a way as to be able to keep this system going. And as time goes on, of course, you would expect that part of the initial money which is going on at the beginning is the surplus that was produced yesterday. In other words, there's a circulation process of this kind. And you would kind of say, well, after a while, you don't need primitive accumulation anymore. You don't need what I call accumulation by dispossession. You might be able to make it simply by taking the surplus that was produced yesterday, the profit you got yesterday, and then reinvesting that, and then that explains where the new money is coming from. But in fact, that is not the whole of the story, because this point of money raises a whole set of questions about what we call barriers to entry. What are the barriers to entry into certain kinds of economic activity? How much money do you need to set up a sort of making shirts with a sewing machine? How much money do you need for a railroad? How much do you need for an integrated iron and steel plant? How much do you need for an automated auto plant? In other words, as time goes on, the whole kind of question is not simply about the money, but how the money is assembled. And actually, at this point, it becomes crucial not to talk simply about what Marx calls the concentration of capital, but to talk about the centralization of capital. Centralization, which brings together capital from all over the place and assembles it in sufficiently large quantities in order to be able to enter into certain lines of production, particularly, something like the Channel Tunnel or, those kinds of things. You need vast amount of capital to be able to do that. Now, this takes, at this point, a tremendous amount of institutional innovation. And, of course, it takes things like savings banks. It takes things like corporate forms. It takes, limited companies and so on. It takes stock markets. It takes all kinds of institutional innovation. So one of the things you would look at in the whole history of capitalism is the history of this sort of innovation. In other words, capitalism has survived by continuous innovation, which allows money to be concentrated in those forms that allow certain lines of production to occur. And without those innovations, capitalism would have come to a block. It would have found a limit. Therefore, there is a tremendous importance to perpetual innovation in the way in which funds get assembled prior to actually entering into the production process. And this is one of the pieces of the history of capitalism which needs to be looked at very, very, very carefully. Now, in assembling this, of course, we also find ourselves immediately having to focus on some other elements of this. We're not simply talking about the construction of profit, we're also talking about how interest works and how credit works. In other words, a lot of this is going to be assembled through the credit system. So in fact, we find even at the front end of all of this, a very important role for the credit system and a very important role for financial innovation, which is absolutely central to the whole history of how capitalism survives. Capitalism would not survive without that. Then there's a big question mark. How does it happen? Who does it? What happens? And all the rest of it. And we can sort of go into that in detail if you want later on. But this is one of the big elements in the history of capitalism that really needs to be looked at. The next point is that once you get in there, you've got to immediately look at these two elements, labor power and means of production. Where does the labor power come from? Where does the means of production come from? When you start to look at the means of production, anybody who enters the market expects to find the necessary materials to pull together into making, you know, cars or making, you know, aircraft or whatever. And the big issue is, how does it get there, and are there sort of problems of proportionality and all the rest of it? And the answer to that is, well, you know, frequently you'll get disproportionalities here and you get blockages here, but then that is something that the price mechanism is supposed to solve, because the price goes up or something and then more people come in to produce the raw material, your means of production, and so it moves in that kind of way. But at the end of this, there also lies a certain relation to nature. That is, there is a pressure in terms of behind the means of production of raw materials and how much we've got in the way of raw materials and where the raw materials are coming from and in what quantities and all the rest of it. Now, what this suggests is that there is a potential blockage in relationship to, well, let's call it the relation to nature, which some people like to call the second contradiction of capitalism, which is the fact that natural resources, put bluntly, are running out, or that the environment cannot stand yet another dose of toxic waste being dumped in it, or something of that kind. So there has, throughout the history of capitalism, been a very considerable interest in the whole idea that limits are set by nature, and that there is a natural limit of some kind. But again, what is fascinating about the history of capitalism, that every time it seems like there's a limit, it's turned into a barrier, and it's circumvented, and it's transcended. And it's interesting to go back and look at the history of the number of times people said capitalism is going to end in the next 15 years because it's peak oil, or it's peak this, or it's peak that, or something's gone out, or something's gone that, and it never happens. But there have to be, obviously, some very serious and very fast adjustments. And the fact that sometimes these adjustments are not done fast enough or means that, indeed, this can act as a drag upon the system. In other words, there is a potential barrier to the continuous flow of capitalism, of continuous flow of capital, simply by virtue of the fact that there are often barriers to, you know, where the resources are going to come from and so on. Now, this entails, however, the mobilization of something which I think has always been terribly important to me, which is to say that the natural resources are not natural. What they are is technological and cultural and economic appraisals of various aspects of nature which we can use in certain kinds of ways. And if you hit some limit on this particular problem, then you change all your culture and your technology and your economy and you adapt. And that has been going on for a very long time. But that doesn't, just because it's worked so far, doesn't mean it's going to work this time around. You know, we should never make that fallacious judgment that this time around, it's going to, the same thing is going to happen. We're going to get out of the sort of supposed peak oil. I don't actually think we are in peak oil, but that's another matter. We can say, we can get out of this and by mobilizing some other forms of energy, and this becomes, as it were, part of the game. But there is no question, I think, that this is one of the points where the whole dynamic of capitalism starts to become very seriously compromised when we start to look at the scale. I mean, I mentioned, you know, in Manchester there were environmental problems, and the peat bogs on the Pennines around Manchester all kind of just, crashed in about 1780 as the acid deposition picked up. It's one thing to sort of say that's going on, another thing to say, well, we're looking at global warming, we're looking at global kind of reconfigurations and the like, and when we're talking about a $40 trillion or an $80 trillion economy, what are we looking at? The pressures on environmental aggregates are likely to be very much stronger simply because of the sheer size, and I think we see that already in many ways, particularly through the industrialization and urbanization of China. The environmental consequences of that around the world have been really quite dramatic. And indeed, there are potential problems lurking there and potential barriers. But again, don't imagine that they cannot be circumvented or transcended in some way. And that's part of the trick of a capitalist dynamic, that it does that again and again. The other issue is the labor supply. Where's your extra labor going to kind of come from, and what's going to go on here? This is something that capitalism, throughout the whole history of capitalism, this has been, a really big issue. The management of the labor resource, the management of the laboring population, and the like. And how you do it and what you do depends very much on all sorts of things. It depends upon the nature of the technology of production which you're going into, which we'll come to in a minute. And it depends a lot on the availability of population and what kind of population you have. But if there is a very serious problem over labor supply, then capital has to find ways to solve it. And one of its big solutions has, of course, been technological change, which creates technologically induced unemployment. You introduce labor-saving innovations, and you need less labor rather than more labor. So instead of the expansion going through more labor, it goes through less labor. And there are, however, some other problems with that, but this is one of the ways to go. The other way is, of course, immigration, or you take your capitalist enterprises to some place where there's a labor surplus. But there are times when, indeed, in the history of capitalism, this blockage has been a very serious one. And there are many people who would talk, for example, about a profit squeeze theory of crisis, which was very prevalent in the 1960s, early 1970s, in which a combination of labor shortages, the lack of mobility of capital, and the militancy of labor organizations were really putting singular pressure upon capitalism. And this was true in, for instance, the strike waves that occurred in Europe sort of the end of the 1960s into the early 1970s. And the response to that is, of course, a variety of things. I mean, it's a bit astonishing now when we look at the sort of the way in which immigration is viewed in Europe that actually in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the French government actually had a subsidized program to import Maghrebian labor. To deal with the labor shortage in France. The Germans, of course, brought the Turks in, the Swedes brought the Yugoslavs in, Britain drew upon its empire, and of course, remember, this country, 1965, you had that massive reorganization of immigration law, which opened up immigration in the United States to a completely different population group than before. So what you find is in the late 1960s, there was a general kind of sense that labor was too powerful, and one of the things you could undermine it was by structuring immigration in some form or other. Or you could start, this is when you start to get offshoring going on after the late 1960s, that starts to be a strategy. And of course, if the technological change didn't work and the immigration didn't work and the export of capital didn't work, then you invented people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, who were going to smash the unions and get rid of all of that oppositional kind of logic. So There was a huge, huge problem in the early 1970s over labor management and labor control. My view right now is the capitalists don't have any problems on the labor front. They have no, I mean, essentially they've solved the labor problem. They've got all of the Chinese population, they cut all of the sort of what's, you know, Russia, they got, you know, I mean, they've got excess labor supplies all over the place. They have a great deal of flexibility in terms of both technologies and also immigration and export of capital and so on. So I don't see this right now being a serious serious barrier to the further accumulation of capital. I just don't see it. I mean, of course, there are particular areas of unrest here and there, and it's not as if labor militancy goes away. It's always there, and in different places it's beginning to emerge. I think the stories that are coming out in China right now suggest that there's quite a lot of labor militancy in China, and it may get even stronger now that unemployment is hitting China. So there's a labor militancy kind of problem always, but effectively I would argue that is not the big issue in the global economy right now in the way it was in, say, the late 1960s, early 1970s. This then brings us to the next point, which is what goes on in the labor process, that production process, that P. Here you're dealing with a number of issues. You're dealing with the technology. What kind of technology do we have, and how are technologies organized? And Marx's concept of technology is rather broader than simply machines. It's about organizational form, it's about software, and it's about hardware. And all of that together is talking about the organizational and tangible forms that the labor process takes. And it is that labor process in which, of course, the laborer participates. And therefore, there is a coming together of laboring activity and these technologies at this particular point. Now, there are two issues here. One is, what is the stimulus, and why are certain technologies adopted, and how and why are those technologies brought into, and what kinds of relationship this means there is in the labor process to the way in which workers work. I mean, the first point in the relation to labor we're looking at is essentially the labor market, how the labor market functions, what the conditions are of the contract to the laborer. Now we're looking at the laborer working. And of course, on this point, laborer does have a certain kind of power. You can go slow, you can throw sand in the works, there's all sorts of things like that. You can refuse to work with certain technologies. You can refuse to work with certain toxic materials on the grounds of health and so on. There are all sorts of things that go on in the labor process which are absolutely fundamental. And clearly, if relations on the shop floor and relations in the labor process get out of hand, you're likely to find a blockage to the system. And so there is a tremendous kind of concern, again, in the history of capitalism, to try to make it in such a way that the laborer is co-opted into the labor process in some way. And there are all sorts of, you know, interesting sort of bits and pieces in this history, the quality circles, the attempt to make the job amusing, the attempt to bring sort of a diversity into the labor process. How that works, and whether you work with downright, outright coercion, whether you use sort of despotic means, or whether you try to persuade people, all those sorts of questions have to get taken up at this particular point in relationship to the organizational forms and the technologies. Now here too, of course, what you find is there's been a considerable lot of innovation in organizational form. For example, over the last 30 years, the emphasis upon subcontracting, the emphasis upon sort of just-in-time systems, if you like, the disaggregation of the labor process into bits and pieces, and the way in which the organizational form works in terms of divisions of labor, all those sorts of issues. And again, you know, when you start to read accounts of what went on in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries about actually how the labor process worked, you find a tremendous variety of struggles going on at this particular point. In other words, you can't say that this point is a passive point. Yeah, they just go into, you know, workers just go into the factory and they just engage in the production process. That doesn't happen. There's something else goes on here, which is a kind of complicated social relation in terms of the organization. And here too, there is a potential barrier, and capitalism has struggled with that barrier and the nature of that barrier for a very, very, very long time. And in different places at different times, it has different solutions and different possibilities. So this is, if you like, again, a point of very, you know, to me it's a very important point to look at that historically and look at it in contemporary conditions. If you look at, for example, labor processes as they're being described now in China and all the rest of it, what you find is a very different kind of way in which labor process is mobilized and controlled and disciplined. And again, there's all sorts of sociality gets involved here, cultural habits get involved, all sorts of issues get involved. This then brings us to the actual creation of the commodity and the sale of the commodity. And this is actually one of the trickier ones. Because here what you'll find is that there's a really interesting question of where is the extra money at the end of the day in relationship to the money that was there at the beginning of the day. Now, fortunately, there's a difference between money used as capital and the total amount of money in society. I have money in my pocket right now and it's not used as capital. So one of the things that capital will try to do is to extract the money in my pocket in such a way that it can actually feed their capital, which means that I have to be prepared to spend it. Therefore, there is a tremendous kind of emphasis again in the history of capitalism to making sure that I spend it in a rational way, rational, that is, from the standpoint of the accumulation of capital, not necessarily rational from the standpoint of my well-being. That then creates, as it were, a tremendous kind of issue over to what degree can you persuade people that they really need this and they have to have that in order to be happy and, you know, and in order to, you know, really have a great time with your partner, you need to use this toothpaste versus that toothpaste or whatever. So you have this whole kind of, those sorts of issues immediately come up here. But then historically, actually, there is two other elements here. First off, at the origins of capitalism, there was a good deal of money out there which, in a sense, was locked up by the feudal classes. In other words, you could say the feudal classes had a gold reserve, if you like, and you could raid the gold reserve and by selling things to the feudal classes. And initially, at least, that gold reserve was a very important aspect of where the money was at the end of the day, selling to the capitalist class, selling to the, you know, the feudal classes, or eventually, of course, mobilizing the feudal classes, particularly peasant classes, and making them pay taxes and things like that and get into the monetary economy, then they became also the market. So that was another aspect. So the kind of the whole history of the relationship to feudal configurations was actually really rather, again, rather important initially in all of this. Rosa Luxemburg pointed out another way, which is, well, if capitalism is really operating in one part of the world, it can go raid another part of the world. And of course, a classic account of this was the Opium Wars. India was a big market for British textiles and all the rest of it. So how are the Indians going to pay for it? Well, they produced some raw materials, but not enough. So they had to find something else to do. So they grew opium and sold the opium to China, and then Chinese silver came to India, and then then it went back to Britain. You know, so this is the kind of an imperialist kind of way of getting access to the surplus. But then, if you kind of figure that we are now in a situation where the feudal classes have really disappeared, where there's not much of a territory left that you can go sort of imperialize like that, and there's not so there's a bit of a tension here, and actually on this point what you find is the following: that there is a dilemma when you isolate, and this is actually true in Marx's Capital. There's a dilemma that when you isolate all of Marx's argument, it's still very difficult to see how the surplus, once it is produced, is realized. And then there is a realization problem. And the trouble with talking about this is that if you do that, then immediately within the Marxist heritage, everybody starts to say, you're an under-consumptionist, aren't you? And if you're an under-consumptionist, that's a dirty word, and you are dismissed immediately for being an under-consumptionist. When actually Marx was talking about You know, he talked about production and realization as being moments in a singular process, and that therefore you couldn't look at one without looking at the other. Now, it's true that in Capital he concentrates very much on production. When he came to look at the realization thing, he never really kind of quite figured out how it was going to work. But what does work in the end is that actually the way in which you realize the surplus from yesterday is through the reinvestment tomorrow. Actually, and this is the way in which the system becomes perpetuated. That actually I mop up tomorrow by the and this is where the expansion comes in, is absolutely necessary for the continuation of a capitalist society. In order for you to actually realize the surplus yesterday, you need to reinvest tomorrow in order to mop up the surplus from yesterday. Now, this isn't a kind of interesting way of looking at it, because it then says, well, there's a timing problem here. And here you kind of go back and you say, well, actually, even in volume one of Capital, Marx realized that the timing problems of meant that money had to be used as a means of payment. And using money as a means of payment involved a relationship between debtors and creditors. And that involves actually paying interest. And so immediately what this does is it says that the gap in the realization process has to be covered by credit institutions. Then it's only through credit institutions that this whole thing can keep going. Now notice, we had credit institutions at the beginning amassing the stuff, and you've got credit institutions at the end of it engaging in the realization of the stuff. And those two unity, if you like, means that the credit system sort of hovers over the whole process in some very, very crucial and very important role. Now, Marx in Capital was reluctant to deal with that for a very simple reason. That is that he wanted to talk about production without actually taking up the issue of the distribution of the surplus between rent and interest and taxes and all the rest of it. So he was trying to do an analysis without getting into the whole kind of problem of interest. So in Capital, Volume 1, he says, well, you know, this will get into interest, but I'm leaving that till later. And then in Capital Volume 2, he says, well, I can't understand fixed capital without understanding interest, but I'll get into that later. I mean, leave that aside. And when he did finally get to it in Volume 3, he left it in such a mess that nobody could understand what the hell he was talking about. And I did the best I could in Limits to Capital to sort that out, and I still think I did a fairly good job. It nearly drove me crazy doing it, to try to sort out. But I think one of the things I didn't quite realize in the way I do now is that the way in which the credit institutions are fundamental at the beginning as well as at the end of this process. Now, what this says is at the end of this process, you've got to get considerable innovation also in the way in which credit institutions work. And one of the things I did when I started to look at the simple kind of question of urbanization and said, well, actually, urbanization is one of the big ways in which you absorb the surplus. But if I look back at that and say, well, how did that happen? I went back in Second Empire Paris, you see financial innovation going on in Second Empire Paris, which is actually crucial to the way in which the surplus gets mobilized and gets realized. And you see that happening. You see the same thing going on in the innovations of the New Deal when we got things like mortgage finance. I mean, before 1933, you couldn't get a mortgage for more than about 3 years, and you had to put a lot of down payment and all the rest of it. And if you wanted to continue it, you had to refinance it. Well, along comes Roosevelt and says, well, actually, a mortgage is a great idea. This is a great way in which we can, mop up the surplus. So we're going to set up a whole new set of institutions like the FHA. And by the way, it happens to be convenient that debt-encumbered homeowners don't go on strike, so that's actually very useful. Socially at a very restive kind of period. So what we do is we sort of innovate in those kinds of ways. And the FHA was not very well capitalized and not very well set up initially, but by the time you get after World War II, there's a whole raft of new financial innovations which come on, which allow the surplus to be mobilized into a massive suburbanization project, but also allows everybody to buy it through mortgages. So that you're operating at both ends of this, and isn't it neat? You lend money to the developer to produce the houses, and then you lend money to the person who purchases it. And it's almost like a perpetual motion machine, you know. So the role of the credit institutions becomes more and more significant. And therefore, What this also means is that financial innovation has been absolutely a crucial aspect, and I would argue in relationship to Marxian theory, it's not been very well articulated, a crucial aspect to the dynamics of how this works. And of course, behind the credit institutions lies the power of the state. Because as Marx pointed out, even about primitive accumulation, the national debt is in fact one of the big ways in which a lot of this is orchestrated, through which a lot of this is orchestrated. So again, the financial institutions are not simply private financial institutions, they're also state financial institutions, because the state has an incredibly important role to play in terms of the money supply, organizing and orchestrating the money supply, setting up the kinds of, again, financial institutions that can regulate it in such a way as that presumably it doesn't get too far out of hand. Now, what I would suggest, however, from this is that there are therefore a number of particular points of difficulty and crisis within this system. The first comes in, can you mobilize the capital you need in the first instance? Then there's a relation to nature. Then there's a question of labor. Then there's a question of the technology and organizational form in the labor process. Then there's a question of how do you sell the stuff at the end of the day and keep the thing going. Each one of those points is potentially a blockage point. And if any one of them sticks, then you've got a crisis on your hands. And one of the problems I have with the way in which many people think about crises under capitalism is to kind of say, well, there's only one theory of crisis you can have. And I'm arguing, no, I think actually there are all kinds of different points of crisis in this, and you have to look at each one of them, and in any particular historical moment, one of them may be more dominant than the other. And it's interesting, by the way, that actually these things tend to go together. For instance, when you solve the labor problem, which I suggested has been solved over the last 30 years, that means that wages tend to stagnate. And if wages stagnate, what does that do to consumption? I.e., you get a realization problem. So actually what happens is that the crisis tendencies bounce around from one moment to the other. You solve this one only at the expense of generating another one. And what can you expect? Why are we surprised at the foreclosure crisis when actually the only way in which people could actually help realize the surplus at the end of the day was to go immensely into debt? So personal household debt has tripled in this country since 1970 or so. So you triple the household debt, wage rates are stagnant. Are you surprised that at some point or other people can't pay off their debts? I mean, my goodness, it takes Paul Bernanke, Bernanke to understand that. You know, I mean, it's obvious. So you've got all of these kinds of sorts of issues in this flow process, but at the same time, the paramount centrality of this credit system and what it's doing and how state and credit are working this system also gets you to the point where indeed this means that you cannot analyze this process simply in terms of the production of the surplus. You've got to look at it also from the standpoint of how interest is working and who it is can start to accumulate wealth through the operation of the financial institutions and the financial sector. So the financial sector starts to move central for that very, very simple kind of reason. Now, as it moves central, so also there are considerable pressures on that center to try to find innovative ways to dispose of the surplus and to circulate the surplus. And that those innovative ways mean that there is bound to be pressure towards financial innovation. There was a clear recognition in the early 1970s on the part of the government and the investment bankers that financial innovation was absolutely crucial, and that therefore financial innovation meant deregulation and the creation of new market forms, and that that was an absolute necessity because there clearly was a blockage of some kind emerging in the 1970s, not only over the labor question, but over the fiscal question. I mean, in other words, this was a period when people talked about the profit squeeze because of labor, but they also talked about a fiscal crisis of the state. And we had a fiscal crisis of New York City and a fiscal crisis of municipal finance and all the rest of it at that time. So it was both a fiscal crisis and a labor crisis, paralleling one another. And the answer to the fiscal crisis was innovation, as it had been back in 1853 and 1854 in Paris, as it had been during the New Deal and after. Fiscal innovation in financial apparatuses became absolutely critical. And when this innovation starts, however, the difficulty is to find out exactly how this innovation is working. And this is where I think what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years should surely scare the pants off you, because there was a regulatory framework in existence, but the financial people in the financial world found ways around it. They did over-the-counter kinds of innovations and all came up with all kinds of new products, and it was very, very exciting for them, I'm sure, to come up with all of these derivatives and derivatives upon derivatives upon derivatives, and they had a great time doing it. But as always happens, there at some point or other, somebody's going to question as to what the real value is behind or what all of these financial derivatives are talking about. Now, in 1990, the total market for derivatives was almost negligible. Hardly any of it was around. I was amazed about 3 years ago to read a piece in the press which kind of said the derivatives market, when you're looking at currency derivatives and interest rate swap derivatives and the total value circulating in these markets is something like $280 trillion. $280 trillion circulating in these markets. What's the total output? 40 trillion. $280 trillion worth of money is circulating through the market when the total output of goods and services in the world is $40 trillion. Go figure. And actually, in this article I was kind of reading, I was saying, well, God, that's incredible. And then they kind of said, they reassured me and said, well, it's the real liabilities in this market, because a lot of this market is simply churning, you know, the real liabilities in this market are only about 10% of that. So I said, oh, that makes me feel much better. It's only $28 trillion in relationship to $40 trillion, where the real liabilities lie. And this is, I think, and it's gone on since then, the last estimate I saw was something like the $600 trillion circulating through this market. Now, this is a form of financial innovation, which is, as Marx called it way back, fictitious capital formation. Now, fictitious capital formation, as you can see, is not a bad thing at the beginning, at the end, because you cannot have this system work without fictitious capital formation. Because at the very beginning, it's fictitious in the sense that I say, I go to you as all investors and say to me, give me all of your money, and all of that money I will put together and I will make something and make you rich. Well, it's not there, it's fictitious. But if I make you rich and I do it at the end of the day, then the fiction becomes real. So it's a matter of always starting with fiction and then ending up with the reality, which is why capitalism is always speculative. And one of the things I think is very objectionable right now is that somebody every now and again isolates out something called speculation as if it's over there. No, speculation is at the heart of what capitalism is about. It's always speculative. It's always speculating on finding a market. It's always speculating on getting money out of my pocket into their pocket. It's always speculating on those kinds of things. So it's a speculative system from beginning to end. And that speculation, however, is not harmful all the time that at the end of the day, I've built a railroad or I've made something or I've done something, you know. In other words, real wealth is generated out of it at the end of the day. But it becomes increasingly hard to see how real wealth can be generated of $28 trillion out of that market. And the problem here, of course, is on the one hand, we're speculating that $28 trillion of wealth can be actually generated out of that market, and the people who are running the market are drawing out $3 billion a year personal remuneration. So on the one hand, you're seeing a tremendous kind of sucking out of wealth from this at the same time as this is largely fictitious capital which is circulating in these markets. And this then becomes a point where you kind of say, well, is there a way in which we could check on how this works? And the answer, I think, is absolutely not. And for a very simple reason. I mean, one of the things I'm worried about right now is all this talk about regulation. Regulation is... we should not be talking about that. For a very simple reason. I mean, ever since the end of the 19th century, there's been a problem which is called regulatory capture. That is, those you're trying to regulate capture the regulating institutions. And that's gone on. That went on in 1910. It's been going on ever since. And the problem right now is they've made these derivative markets so complicated that the only people in the world who understand what's going on is them. So they have to regulate. They're the ones who are going to regulate it. So actually, by definition, for technical expertise reasons almost, right now, any regulatory apparatus is going to have to be, it's a bit like asking the wolf to, regulate itself. And so the regulation thing is kind of really, but the second reason why regulation won't work is because these things are so very complicated right now. And they're complicated in a way that all that regulation does is to introduce another layer of complication, another layer in which things can go wrong. I mean, even if you had totally independent people who were not part of the not part of those being regulated, even if they were totally independent, the idea that they would have sufficient information and sufficient understanding to make exactly the right decision so that things would not go even worse is kind of pretty much it. So actually, the only way you can do this is to abolish certain kinds of financial markets, full stop. So you get rid of derivative trading. I mean, we did without it before 1990. We just banned derivative trading, full stop. Now, what would happen if you did that? First off, those people who are pulling out, $3 billion a year out of these markets would not have a market to go into. What would they do, poor things? They probably go John Corzine, they go into politics or something, So the point here is that actually what is required right now is a complete restructuring of the financial institutions and financial institutional structure. No way in which you can regulate it in such a way that it will be sufficient. And I think that is why everybody's going on about the failures of regulation. Yes, there were failures of regulation, but there are going to be even more failures of regulation down the line. So there's no way in which the regulatory thing is going to work. So there too, I think we have to see that. Now, what this then finally says is this, that if we did indeed look at that regulatory apparatus, the financial credit apparatus at the end, let us suppose that we socialized the surplus. That is, it's interesting, the state right now is effectively nationalizing banking institutions and nationalizing them, however, without exercising any control over them. In other words, they're taking equity stakes in a bank and then saying we have zero voting rights. Now, as an investor, would you think that was a sensible thing to do? To say, here, take all my money and I'm not going to have any influence over what you do with it. That's crazy. So here it seems to me the only way to work is to start to put pressure on the state apparatus to try to sort of actually enter into the fact that there's going to be an overt, almost complete nationalization of the banking system. And that is, in effect, what's happening. But we don't call it that. We call it everything else, and we don't want to call it by that name because that is socialist or Marxist or something horrible like that, which is the end of civilization. But this, however, brings me, if you like, to the whole kind of question. Actually, the way in which this surplus has been managed over the last 30 years, there's been an intense attempt by upper classes to control the surplus entirely on their own. In other words, to remove all forms of popular or social power over what happens to the surplus and who gets it. That's what neoliberalism has been about all along, and that's what it continues to be about and will continue to be about unless we're prepared to kind of actually look at what it seems to me is the heart of the problem, which is this production and continued growth of the surplus, first off, the 3% compound rate of growth forever. I think there's a very serious problem with that, and something's got to be done in relationship to that. We have to start to think about a zero-growth economy, and a zero-growth economy is totally incompatible with a continuation of capitalism. Otherwise, we will get a zero-growth economy, and it'll be very uncomfortable to live with. We're probably just going to go into a phase of that over the next year, and we'll see how uncomfortable it is to live with that. So that's the first problem, controlling the surplus and bringing that surplus production down in some way where it doesn't create the kinds of stresses that it's currently creating. The second thing is to start to actually think about how to use the surplus in ways which are socially beneficial as opposed to the perpetuation of class power. Because that is where we are at, very simply. The surplus is being used and is being abused in terms of the concentration and centralization of even more class power. And the only way in which that can be checked is simply by trying to get democratic control over the production and use of the surplus. And there are various ways in which we can think about that. One of those is through things like the centralization of the means of credit in the hands of the state, which is in effect what's happening right now. The other way is to start to think of ways in which to socialize the profit rate. And there was a wonderful plan once called the Rehn-Meidner plan in Sweden, which failed, but which was a great idea. It just said we tax corporate profits and we put it into a social fund, and the social fund invests in the corporation, and after 20 years the social fund controls the corporation. And we've got rid of the capitalists. And of course, they immediately turned around and they organized a Nobel Prize for Hayek and Friedman and other people because they didn't like that idea at all, as you can imagine. So the ideological assault they mobilized was also crucially important. So there, if you like, it seems to me, is the enigma of capital. That it's managed, if you like, to survive all of these transition points over the years and managed to do it through innovation, technological, organizational, financial, and also through radical transformations of labor relations and divisions of labor and all the rest of it. And we can look at that historically, we can look at it in a contemporary kind of way. So when Catherine asks her familiar question, where's the ethnography? The answer is, well, you go into one of these labor processes and watch what's happening in the labor process or whatever. Or you go into one of these financial institutions and you watch these guys innovate the way they're doing with this over-the-counter trading and all the rest of it. I mean, that's what you do. So that's my ethnographic contribution to the evening. And with that, I'll leave it. Thanks very much.